Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Namaste. I'm Divina Gupta. And on this edition, we're talking about the story of US job market. What is it like to work in the world's largest economy, and are jobs available?
It's a buyer's market for brains and a seller's market for brawn. Recruiters are struggling still.
We also go to Baltimore to hear what's changed for the lorry drivers after the collapse of City's Key Bridge.
Coming back Friday, it took me 6.5 hours to get home. And I like to drive, but I don't like to sit. There's really no choice, so, you know, if you want to work. But it's a nice little ride.
And how the G20 nations are planning to tax the super rich.
You look at billionaires paying in proportion sometimes twice as less as the rest of the population.
All that and more on World Business Report, so stay with us. Now, we've been following the brewing trade tensions between Turkey and Israel on the show. Yesterday, Turkey decided to suspend all trade with Israel over the conflict in Gaza, citing the worsening humanitarian tragedy in the Strip. And this is what Turkey's trade minister, Ömer Bulut, said.
As of yesterday, the halt of exports and imports to and from Israel will be implemented until a permanent ceasefire in Gaza is secured, as well as unhindered humanitarian aid flows to the region.
Now, Israeli Foreign Ministry has announced a series of retaliatory steps against Ankara. In a statement, it has decided to approach international forums against Turkey's sanction for violating existing trade agreements, find alternatives to support Israel's economy, and more importantly, it has decided to reduce Turkish imports to the occupied Palestinian territories. So earlier I spoke with Professor Fawaz Shuzaziz, who is Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics, and asked him how this might affect the fragile economy in the region.
What we need to understand is that the Palestinian economy has been hit very hard as a result of the Israel war in Gaza. The Palestinian economy was really almost broken before the Hamas attack on Israel on the 7th of October. But now it has been decimated. As a result, in particular, that Palestinian workers can no longer really go to Israel, work there, and bring resources home. And also, as a result of the war itself, which has weighed down the Palestinian economy both in Gaza and in the West Bank. Unemployment is extremely high. In a way, really, the Palestinian economy is a shadow of its former self on the West Bank. So any kind of pressure, any kind of sanctions will basically exacerbate an already severe economic crisis in the occupied West Bank.
How do goods get in to the occupied territories? I mean, they have to pass through Turkey, isn't it? Or are there independent trade frontiers from where they can come in?
Everything that comes into the West Bank has to be basically sanctioned by Israel, period. Whether you're talking about Jordan or whether you're talking about Egypt, I mean, you're talking about multiple entries. But it's really the point of entry, Israel. Nothing enters the West Bank without the seal of approval of Israel.
How far does this retaliation from Israel, as we've seen after the sanctions that Turkey has imposed on trade, go in impacting the Palestinian economy?
Any kind of action will most likely impact the Palestinian economy in the occupied West Bank, because the economy itself has been suffering from a severe economic crisis. It has contracted. Unemployment has skyrocketed as a result of Israel's shutting down, basically entry of Palestinian workers into the West Bank. But I think the larger point here, I think we're missing a big point. What Turkey has done by suspending all trade to Israel, by blocking ports for import and export to Israel, this is a major, major blow to the Israeli economy, period. What Israel is trying to do is to retaliate, and its retaliation will most likely hurt the Palestinian economy, which is basically weighed down, I mean, severely as a result of the war. So in a way, even though Israel is hurt as a result of the suspension of trade, all trade by Turkey to Israel, but the Palestinians will suffer also a great deal, in particular the Palestinians on the West Bank and in East Jerusalem.
Well, Israel has said that it's trying to create alternatives to imports from Turkey by increasing local production and finding other possible routes for supply chain. Now, do you think this is possible for the occupied Palestinian territories? Will it trickle down to them?
No, not really. I mean, I think what do you expect Israel to say? Do you expect the Israeli foreign ministry to say, well, we're going to be hurt? We are really terribly affected by what Turkey has done. I think the suspension, Turkey's suspension, all trade of Israel, is really should be seen in the context. What we are really seeing now is Israel is being globally isolated, I mean, in many parts of the world. And in fact, the Turkish government has made it very clear. What they have done is really an integral part. What they want to is really increase their pressure on Israel in order to accept ceasefire and to allow humanitarian aid to the Palestinians in Gaza.
That was Fawaz Shahzozis, professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. Foreign Minister of Israel has said, we will not surrender to President Erdogan's blackmail and threats. The Israeli economy is stronger. Now, to the big numbers everyone has been talking about, and those are that of the US job growth figures. The latest data shows that 175,000 jobs were added in April, the smallest rise for 6 months. It is a good news for the economy in a way. Chris Lowe is chief economist with FHN Financial based in New York, is joining us. Chris, just tell us why.
Well, I think the most important thing is that robust job growth was one of the things fueling inflation here in the U.S. And of course, 175,000 is still a pretty solid gain. But beyond that, too, a lot of the seasonal hiring for the spring, especially in construction and at restaurants, that was very strong in March, slowed down in April. And I think a big part of that was simply that spring came early in parts of the U.S., allowing the hiring to take place sooner.
And this has also raised speculation whether it's now to ensure that the borrowing costs, which are really high, will come down, and whether the central bank of the U.S. will take that decision to cut the rates. But for more on this, I earlier spoke with chief economist at Glassdoor, Aaron Terezas, about how is he looking at these figures.
The jobs market has been very strong, but you dig beneath the surface and there really are two very different labor markets happening right now. At the upper end of the skill spectrum, there is a lot less demand. Workers are struggling to find jobs. At the lower end of the skill spectrum, when it comes to the vocational trades and it comes to frontline service work, demand continues to be there, and we are still seeing outsized wage gains, again, at the bottom of the skill distribution.
Is it also sector-specific? Because certain sectors, if they're doing better than the others, where this gap is not so much?
Of course, a big part of this skill gap, skill divergence, is driven by the industries that are booming and struggling right now in the United States. We know that interest rates are many things. One thing that they are is the cost of risk, and the cost of risk is a lot higher than it was 2 years ago at this point. And so any risk-intensive industry, you think tech, you think finance, all of those are reevaluating their investments, reevaluating their labor needs for the foreseeable future. That is not the case when it comes to sectors like manufacturing, construction, or of course, healthcare, which is a perennial source of growth.
How are employers approaching this labor market, and how are they trying to get to the recruitment that they need?
One way that I've framed it is that it's a buyer's market for brains and a seller's market for brawn. Recruiters are struggling still to find frontline service workers, workers with vocational skills, but they are finding a lot of workers who have graduate degrees, highly educated tech and quant workers that are out there. They're finding them. a lot more intensive interviewing. Skilled workers are applying to a lot more jobs than they had to this time last year.
And what's been the wage growth like in, say, the skilled worker categories then?
Wage growth across the economy has slowed. That was one of the bright spots in today's jobs report. It fell below 4% for the first time in 2 years. At the other end, we've seen 10% plus minimum wage increases in some parts of the country for, again, restaurant and frontline service work.
And how does this impact the problem of inflation?
When you look at what is driving inflation, it is still gas, groceries, and shelter, housing costs. That said, there is a sense that wages have not been the driving force for a lot of the inflation we've seen in the economy over the past 2 years.
And when you look at the demand for white-collar jobs going down in several portions of the economy, what's the long-term impact of that?
White-collar workers are nervous at this particular junction for the economy. You think around the trends of AI and generative AI. You think around the trends of remote work and globalization for skilled services like software engineering. There is more competition for those white-collar jobs than there has been perhaps ever before. And demand, employers have a lot more sources of supply.
If there's a young graduate who's looking for a white-collar job, what's your advice to them?
The best advice right now is to take an open mind. We like to think of tech and professional services as this narrow industry, but the reality is this skill set is broadly applicable in a lot of industries. And so there are opportunities for this skill set beyond the historically narrow tech corridors and tech companies that a lot of people look to first.
But could the cycle see a turnaround?
Sooner or later, it's clear that the market is going to move back toward balance. The pendulum swings one way and then it swings the other. But I think a lot of these concerns are going to linger. The concerns about the sustainability of labor demand for skilled services when it comes to AI and globalization of professional services, those are not going to disappear overnight.
Are you also seeing that there is a difference when it comes to the number of hours people are working?
The average hours that workers work is starting to fall back. That's usually something we see as the economy slows. Right now, a lot of that has been driven by two sectors, manufacturing and hospitality.
That was Aaron Terrazas of the job search company Glassdoor joining me from the US. And he talked about one sector, which is tech, and how it's being impacted by AI. An independent layoff tracking site called layoffs.fii has noted that 75,000 workers have been laid off just in 2024 by tech companies. And that's a lot if you look at the U.S. economy. And one of the people who was laid off is Nasser El Samadisi, whose job hunting began last October. And he's from the tech industry. And I asked him, what is it like then to search for a job in this kind of condition?
I've been actively searching on LinkedIn, on Indeed, through my connections, applying to lots of opportunities, lots of jobs. And I've had a lot of interviews, and not just like recruiter interviews, but went through quite a few rounds with quite a few companies, and in the end, didn't get anywhere. So my understanding is, and some of these places are actually kind enough to set up a meeting and explain, hey, we liked you, this is what we thought, and this is why we decided not to go with you.
What have they been saying?
The summary of it, you're amazing at 99% of the stuff, but there's this one thing that we want better. But again, it seems like the job market's flooded with great people and everybody's looking for a unicorn. And at the same time, they're looking to pay less.
How optimistic are you that you'll be able to find a job in the current economic situation in near term?
Oh, God. I've been optimistic since day one. I'm not sure if that means that I'm horrible at judging this kind of thing.
Are you willing to compromise on your wages?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like I'm in talks right now for something that I'm going to seriously have to take about half of what I used to take. And I have to relocate and there's going to be no relocation assistance. And I honestly don't know if it's going to be enough money to make ends meet. But what it will be is a whole lot slower hemorrhaging of my savings than currently what I'm doing. Like I had tons of money saved up for my son's university, and I've been using that to pay rent, electricity, so on and so forth.
Tough choices there for Nasser al-Samadisi, who is hunting for a job in Texas in the US. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, let's head to Baltimore. In March, we covered the story of how the city's iconic Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed after a container smashed into one of its support pillars. And as the efforts are now underway to rebuild it, last Sunday was a big day there because the port welcomed its first container ship since the tragedy. The ship streamed in through a temporary 35-foot channel opened up at the end of last week, which allowed ships that have been stuck in the port for weeks to leave it. Now, even the slow return of vessel traffic is a bright spot for thousands of workers and small business owners who move cargo in and out of the port of Baltimore. Amy Scott from Marketplace spent some time at a warehouse and trucking business near the port to find out how it's been adapting.
Inside an 80,000-square-foot warehouse in Baltimore, a young man unloads boxes of canned albacore tuna from the back of a truck and stacks them on a pallet. Next, the pallet will get wrapped in stretchy plastic and whisked away on a forklift to be stacked among food from China, Europe, and South America.
We have lemon juice. We have banana chips. A lot of olives.
Sue Monahan founded Baltimore International Warehousing and Transportation in 1987. Today, she has four warehouses and 70 employees. And before the Key Bridge collapsed last month, she says most of this cargo would have come in on container ships through the Port of Baltimore, just 10 minutes away. Now it's arriving at the Port of Norfolk, Virginia, several hours to the south, or in New York, to the north.
So other truckers are bringing it to the warehouse where normally we would take it in. Our own trucks would pick it up. So we lose out on that revenue.
After the bridge collapsed, Monahan still had some containers to pick up at the port. But with no more coming in, she had to lay off most of her drivers. She left it to HR manager Kristen Perrin to have those conversations.
They were difficult. A lot of them were understanding, like they expected it. They knew it would be coming. But it's probably the worst part of my job.
But a few weeks later, Monahan says the state approved the company for a worker retention grant.
Which will allow us to keep the drivers employed, even when we don't have a full day for them. They don't have to collect unemployment, which is not enough money for them to live on. So we'll be able to at least keep them employed, we think, until the cargo returns to Baltimore.
And in the meantime, they've done the paperwork and permitting so their own drivers can pick up and deliver at the ports of Norfolk and Philadelphia. Monahan was able to call all of her 16 staff drivers back.
It's a map of where all the drivers are.
In the dispatch office, a large screen shows each driver's location on a map. A week earlier, it would have been mostly empty. But now, several names with their truck numbers are moving throughout the region, tracked by GPS.
And you can see there's some drivers in Norfolk, some coming back from Norfolk. We have drivers up in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. They don't like to be tracked, but I love it.
In the early afternoon, one of those drivers pulls into the yard. How's it going?
How you doing?
Laquan Jefferson has just returned from delivering an empty container to Norfolk. He's been driving with the company for 8 years and says the last couple weeks were tough.
When you get that phone call saying, sorry, we're going to have to let you go, and you got children and bills and everything to pay, you get worried about certain things, but luckily, they called me back.
He's still getting used to the long drive. He started his day at 3 a.m., and it took him 4.5 hours going down to Virginia.
Coming back, it depends on what time you leave. Friday took me 6.5 hours to get home. And I like to drive, but I don't like to sit.
Still, he'd rather sit in traffic than at home not getting paid.
There's really no choice, so, you know, if you want to work. But it's a nice little ride.
One he probably won't have to do much longer. The Army Corps of Engineers plans to reopen the port's main shipping channel by the end of May. But Sue Monahan says that won't mean business as usual.
Vessels still won't come to Baltimore because the steamship lines are not booking cargo to Baltimore until the channel opens. So I think it's going to be another month, month and a half, before those ships come back to Baltimore.
This has all been pretty instructive for her daughter, Shannon, who wants to take over the business someday.
She's getting quite an education.
Yeah, you still want to take it over after this?
Shannon Monahan says, yeah.
We're still here. We're still going. All of our trucks are here now and moving.
Now they're hoping their customers will stick with them until business does get back to normal.
Amy Scott reporting there from Marketplace. Now a question for you. Do you know how many billionaires are there in the world? Well, if you have to take a guess, here's a study that says there are at least 3,000 of them. And in recent years, we know that rich are getting richer. And unfortunately, the poor are getting poorer. So how can we plug this gap? Well, Brazil is proposing that there should be a new global annual tax for the super rich. The country's government has gone ahead and commissioned the EU Observatory to outline their plans, which will be presented at the Group of 20 Nations Meet, or G20, in July. Quintin Paranello is their spokesperson and senior policy advisor.
When you look at the wealth concentration of billionaires over the past decade, it has skyrocketed. And at the same time, those very same people pay in proportion less taxes than the rest of the population.
What's the difference?
So we're facing, well, it really depends on countries. But what's significant is that when you look at official tax data, regardless of the tax system, you look at billionaires paying in proportion sometimes twice as less as the rest of the population, being in the US or in France or in continental Europe. And what we're trying to address with the proposal that we put at the G20 is to recreate progressivity in our tax system, to generate extra revenues to invest in social needs, in climate-friendly investments, and also to rebuild trust in our society, because we need to show that governments are able to work for the greater good. When you're trying to design such a tax at the national level, the first issue that comes up is the risk of those ultra-net-worth individuals threatening to leave. But actually designing a global tax would actually help a long way in addressing these problems. So that's one. Then, and I think it's really important, you have massive popular support for these taxes across countries, across political spectrum, and you even have sometimes billionaires supporting this.
In the Middle East, for example, where there's no income tax in countries like the UAE, for example, how do you plan to get them on board?
We're saying that we should have a minimum tax for the billionaires, minimum income tax, but taking into account the various streams of income taxes paid by the very rich, by the billionaires. And of what fraction should that minimum be expressed? We believe that the fraction should be of wealth, because this is the least manipulable asset. And the central scenario that we designed would be a 2% minimum tax based on wealth. So if you already pay a lot of income taxes that correspond to the equivalent of 2% of your wealth, you do not pay additional taxes. If you pay less than that, then a top-up applies.
And but why just 2%? Why not more?
Well, this is a central scenario, and you're absolutely right that this is not up to economists based in Paris, New York, or London to decide that. This will be up to governments to decide that in a global forum. We model the central scenario of 2% of wealth, and that minimum tax based on 2% of wealth would yield $250 billion globally. This is more than the minimum tax on corporations. So we're already looking at an ambitious scenario, but you are absolutely right that we could look at even more ambitious scenarios that would target even more the richest in our society.
Who gets the share of this tax basket then? Does it stay with different countries, or is it a global pool? And then it's redistributed, especially to low-income economies then?
When you look at the history of those taxes, you have one legitimate view, that is to say that those very rich people, they're resident in one country, they became rich in that country. It's in part due to the education system, to the health system, to the infrastructure in that country. So it's only fair that the taxing rights are located in that country.
Okay.
There's another view that is as legitimate, that says that those billionaires have global assets, global companies with access to global markets that emit carbon on a global scale. So the taxing rights should be more distributed.
You can imagine the criticism for it, because on the other side, there could be arguments that the super rich, or the billionaires, usually are investing in the economy in terms of building industries, creating jobs. And this kind of taxation then just may stifle growth and that kind of innovation.
If you look at the standard growth rate of standard household over the past 30 years, corrected of inflation, it's roughly 1 or 2% over the past 30 years. If you look at the growth rate of global billionaires' wealth over the past 30 years, once again, corrected of inflation, it's around 7 or 8%. So if you look at a 2% levy, 2% minimum tax, we're not actually undermining investment capacities of billionaires. What we're trying to do is to reset some progressivity in the tax system, to rebuild trust and to raise additional resources.
That's Quentin Paranillo, Senior Policy Advisor at Tax Observatory, joining me from France. Chris is still with me. Chris, ready to pay the super rich tax?
Thankfully, that one won't hit me. But I do know here in the U.S. it would be welcomed by our government, because we are running some very persistent big deficits.
And it has been a political talking point in the U.S. elections as well, with President Biden pushing for it. But thank you so much, Chris Lowe, Chief Economist, FHN Financial, joining me from New York. You've been listening to World Business Report on the BBC World Service. See you soon again. Namaste.